All right. Good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is the 1981 election in Israel. 1981, the year I was born, and the election happened about 10 days before my birth.
I don't remember.
Okay, so... Yeah. Well, I want to discuss the election, not from the standpoint of all the parties, but only the two major parties. And the reason why is because this election of 1981 for the 10th Knesset was the first time that it was crystal clear to the Israeli voting public that they were in a two-party system. Certainly in the early years of the state, it was a one-party system in the sense that Mapai was always going to win, and there was only a question of what kind of representation would the other constituencies get and who would be in the coalition. Between 1965 and 1977, you had the building of two large blocks on the left and on the right, and in 1977, the right side of the aisle finally won. But even in 1977, the existence of the Democratic Movement for Change, the DMC, which won 15 seats, obscured the fact that things were moving towards a two-party system. The DMC ceased to exist. It crumbled under its own weight within a year of its establishment. So that in 1981, there was no third party of any significance. There only were two. And as we shall see, that hurts all the boutique parties, because now if you want to participate in determining who will run the country, you have no choice but to vote for one of the two major parties. So what was the fate of Labour and Likud? What were they doing up until election day? Well, let's start with Labour. Labour, having been in the opposition since the summer of 1977, was in a quandary over several things. Number one, who will be their leader? So Rabin had walked away just before the 77 election because of personal family scandal, Rabin bank account, and Peres had gone into the election as the replacement candidate and lost. He held control over the party for the next few years and did his very best to rebuild the party from the ground up and was very good at it. Okay, he was an excellent political operator while in the opposition for those few years. But Rabin challenged him for the leadership in December of 1980 and had a strong base of support. Peres won 70% to 30%, and a deal was reached within the party apparatus that all patronage will be divided on a basis of 70 to 30. The Peresites get 70% of the gigs, and the Rabinites get 30% of the gigs. But this actually was a big problem for Labour. Aside from the fact that you don't have a consensus prime ministerial candidate because there are still people who don't like Shimon, it's also that the personal loyalty and personal rivalry obscures all the other tension that exists in society and in the party. Matters of religion and state, matters of ethnicity, matters of class, and even matters of ideology somehow played second fiddle to, are you a Peres guy or are you a Rabin guy? And that's not a good way to build up a coherent platform going into a national election.
Not security, right?
So security, there was limited difference between Peres and Rabin. Peres had been perceived as the hawk and Rabin as the dove in the 1970s, and that was a fair assessment by the public of their various positions. But between 1977 and 1981, Peres became much more dovish, so that in 1981 he was espousing a deal with the Jordanians, which would mean the relinquishment of a significant portion of the West Bank and Gaza. Like, that would be their party platform going into that election. The Labour Party is pushing forward this Jordanian option, and they believe that if nothing is done on the West Bank and Gaza in terms of recognizing the Palestinian national interest and giving them some sort of a stake in their own affairs, and if the occupation continues, then Israel will cease to be a Jewish state. That the Jewish majority will be gone, and you'll have a binational state.
Was
so that's...
Fair? That assessment?
That assessment? So, the answer is 37 years later, or 38 years later, it was right and it was wrong. It was right in the sense that their opponents, the Likud party, had no ready solution for the problem, and 38 years later, there is no solution to the problem. They were wrong in the sense that Israel was able to pull off another 38 years of occupation and get away with it.
But how about the numbers, the majority?
The numbers don't matter. because since Israel never annexed the West Bank, you could have 20 million Arabs in the West Bank and they're not citizens. The problem is in perception and in morality, not in pure politics. In pure politics, it only makes a difference if they're given the right to vote, which has never happened and will never happen. Okay, so the Labour Party projects itself as the rightful owners of the Israeli bureaucracy and government. That 1977 was a fluke, should never have happened, and shouldn't happen again. The argument was that Begin is unstable and unsuitable for being the head of government. That the ship of state is going to be in dangerous waters if you leave it into his hands again.
But the peace process with Egypt didn't count.
It counted, and the electorate very much appreciated it, but Labour is going to ignore that for the moment. That's going to be a Likud talking point. The slogan will be, anyone but Likud. Rak lo Likud. Like, you know, like the Democrats have, you know, any rational person, 2020. You know, it's the same sort of thing. That Begin was being accused of being beyond the pale. Someone who had no business in charge of a government. And at times, Beginism was referred to as fascism. So all the nasty rhetoric is being trotted out. This will be the ugliest election in Israel's history. Ad Hayom Hazeh, 1981 was the ugliest.
This isn't great either.
This is nothing compared to 1981. So the Labour Party has a strategy. And that is to say, man against man, like in a basketball game, 5-on-5, man against man, not a zone defense, but a man on man. Who compares better, Labour or Likud? Who would you rather have as the Prime Minister, Shimon Peres or Menachem Begin? Who would you rather have as the Defense Minister, an anti-democratic Vilde Chaya like Ariel Sharon, or Chaim Bar-Lev, an upstanding former Chief of Staff?
Sharon's a hero.
Huh?
Sharon
may be a hero, but you can depict him as being an over-the-top bulldozer who doesn't follow orders. You can depict anybody the way you want, and if people buy into it, they'll buy into it. And who do you want as foreign minister, Abba Iben or Yitzhak Shamir? So man against man, the shadow government versus the actual government, what's a more compelling case? And Labour thought they had a more compelling case. In 1980, Labour was doing very well in the polls. In the summer of 1980, the polls said Labour would win 60 seats, something they never did before, and that Likud would win 17. That's nothing. They'd be trounced. So the sitting government would have no chance of re-election, according to the 1980 pollsters. But of course, elections happen on election day, not a year before election day. Well, when is election day? The answer is, it's supposed to be in November of 81. But Begin calculates that, you know what, we're better off pushing it up a little bit and making it at the end of June, June 30th of 81, because his government is teetering on the brink of collapse. In the 9th Knesset, between 77 and 81, many of the parties were fraying at the seams and breaking apart, such that there were many independent members of Knesset sitting alone, not as a faction, but just as, here I am, it's me, and I don't have any compatriots. Well, about six of them were members of the coalition. And it's not an easy thing to run a razor-thin coalition with six independent members being their own factions. At a moment's notice, the whole thing could collapse. Therefore, press for an earlier election. Of course, you only really do that if you think you have a chance of winning. How does Begin think that the Likud is going to win? What is the Likud strategy? So, first of all, and I mentioned it last time, there's the financial consideration. The Likud government, with liberal members of the Likud, meaning not the Herut members of Likud, but the liberal party members of the Likud, had been running the finance ministry and had been working their hardest to control inflation and problems in the labor market. And they failed. All their efforts to liberalize the currency and the economy failed. The lira was changed to the shekel at a ratio of 10 to 1 in 1980, and that didn't even help. So two finance ministers came and went, and the third finance minister, Yoram Aridor, gave away an election time bribe of cutting back the taxes on color television, on washing machines, on cars, and on air conditioners. But moreover, not just that people could afford color televisions, but the Prime Minister's office instructed the Israel Broadcasting Authority that all programming now must be in color, whereas previously it was half black and white. So not only do you have the color TV, but you can watch color TV on your color TV. Okay, so this went over very well with the electorate. What else does the government try to do to boost itself before the election? So, one thing is, cut out the infighting. Menachem Begin instructs those members of the government who are still in the government, as opposed to Weizmann and Dayan and the others who had left, stop the infighting. We want to be perceived as a united party that goes to the polls with a coherent platform and a coherent list of slate of candidates, in contrast to the Labour Party, which is fighting among themselves, where Rabin and Peres don't like each other. Okay. But a lot of this stuff is just window dressing. The real issue in this election was the social divide, the tribalism of Israel at the time, which is typically understood as an issue of Ashkenazim versus Sephardim, but that's dumbing it down too much, because there were plenty of Ashkenazim who voted for the Likud and some Sephardim who voted for Labor. About a third of each ethnic branch voted for the wrong team, which means you can't simply say it's one side versus the other. But there was a sense that the Labor Party represents old Israel, the nostalgia for what once was Eretz Yisrael Hayafa, beautiful Israel. Beautiful in what sense? That they were white people. Okay? That the Ashkenazim came first and the Sephardim came second. And that in the old days you had socialism, you had kibbutzim, you had valiant fighters in the Haganah and in the Tzahal. And we built this country. It's our country. And then on the other side, second Israel. The people who listen to wild music and eat spicy food and speak in a odd dialect. That was the way things were being depicted. Okay, first Israel versus second Israel. So elitist Ashkenazim versus the underclass.
Can I ask how religion fit into that?
Yes, it fits in very nicely. The Labour Party had a historic relationship with the National Religious Party. And that broke down in the late 1970s. And the National Religious Party then developed an alliance of sorts with the Likud. Give me 5 minutes to answer your question. And at the end of the 5 minutes, you'll understand why it's the answer to the question. So why was there a historic partnership between the Mapai and the early Labour and the Maftal, the National Religious, the Mizrahi movement? There are three reasons why. One reason is the fear that if we don't get along, there'll be a Kulturkampf. That if the secularists and the moderate national religious cannot agree to cooperate in the building of the Yishuv in the pre-state era and the early state era, this all will fall apart. We will not have a Jewish country with a Jewish population if we cannot reconcile the integrationist religious types and the plurality socialists. So, lest we all die in the Titanic, we have to get together and cooperate. That's reason number one. Reason number two, proximity of ideology. That on matters of national defense and on matters of the economy, for the most part, the National Religious Camp and the Labor Party were in agreement. They, in other words, they were not extreme activist Irgunists, and they were not pacifist communists. They were defend the country and have a moderately socialist economic system. The third reason for their historic alliance was because Ben-Gurion never wanted to have a major left-wing bloc or a major right-wing bloc. He always wanted the Mapai to be the plurality and everyone else to be a middle or small level party. And until 1965, that was true. Why did he want that? Because it guaranteed him the prime ministership, that he would be in charge he'd be the boss of all bosses. But of the various middle to lower level parties with whom he could work, the best ones were those that didn't have aspirations for national leadership. And who doesn't have aspiration for national leadership? The National Religious Party, because they know that they're 10% of the population or 15% of the population. They'll get that amount of Knesset seats in Genug. That's it. Okay? So it's a beautiful relationship that works on so many levels. But that broke down between the late 60s and late 70s. Why did it break down? For all three reasons, actually. Number one, on the issue of the Kulturkampf. So the truth of the matter is, the status quo was in place, and matters of religion and state had basically been resolved, but the left side of the aisle was now becoming increasingly anti-clerical. Why was it becoming anti-clerical? Because whereas Mapai and Ben-Gurion could make their peace with Rabbi Maimon, Rabbi Fishman, and the others, Achdut HaAvodah and the Mapam, which are now in the alignment, hate anybody with a beard and a yarmulke. So the Labour Party was becoming more and more anti-religious precisely because it was a catch-all left-of-center party that includes the real, the Jew-hater types. Okay. And as for the issues of proximity of ideology, that's no longer the case. After the Six-Day War, or at least after the Yom Kippur War, the National Religious Party is becoming territorially maximalist at a time when the Labour Party is thinking about territorial concessions to the Arabs. And on the third level, the issue of, well, coalition building strategic as opposed to purely ideological, well, once the Likud Party wins, then there's no reason for an alignment between the National Religious Party and the Labourites. The National Religious Party is going to go where their bread is buttered, which is in the government, a Likud government. So for all these reasons, it breaks down. And the Labour Party is becoming increasingly anti-religious. And it's obvious that they are anti-religious. Okay. So...
But they were never religious. They were never...
But they're becoming less tolerant of a role for religious parties in the governing of the country. And especially after what happened between 77 and 81, when the Aguda and the National Religious were both in the cabinet... And there really were no others other than Likud in the cabinet. Certain laws were passed, and a certain culture politically was evolving, whereby the Haredim and the modern Orthodox have too much power at the expense of everybody else. So the relationship is finished, over.
So what I heard, that the yeshivas were always getting all this money from the government, they were always getting this much support, and they would throw their votes, which they could as a bloc, behind anyone who wrote the biggest check.
So that's not really true, because from 1952 to 1977, the Aguda was not in the government. 25 years. Okay, but after 1977, they'd almost always be in the government. Almost. Not always, but almost. Because they develop an affinity for the Likud.
Did
okay.
The NRP have an affinity with Labour because of Paul Mizrahi?
So yes, ideologically, on matters of the economy, the Paul HaMizrahi was the larger element of the NRP. The Mizrahi itself was only like 25%. The Paul HaMizrahi was about 75%. They merged in 1956. They had kibbutzim moshavim, correct. They were many of them were ardent socialists, basically, but with a religious overtone. Yeah. Okay, and in 1981, the Paul HaAguda is destroyed, never to be seen again. And why, I'll explain soon. Okay. So, with this ethnic strife that's developing, you have violence. Violence. Violence isn't good. Nobody likes violence. But it's only one side that's being violent. The Labourites are presenting themselves as polite Westerners. And the Likud types are being seen as hooligans running wild in the street. So I only have one ad for you tonight. Normally I bring a bunch of ads, but tonight I only have one. But one is enough tonight, because it says it all. Here you have, on the left side of the page, a picture of people, darker-skinned Jews with curlyish hair and mustaches. Look, they could be Arabs, for all you know. Except that they're not. They're Sephardic Jews, and they're holding the Machal sign. Machal was the letters of the ballot box for Likud. And on the right side it says, Hapam ata chayav livchor ben mitziut kazot levein mishtar naor. Now you have to choose between a reality like this, a vildachayas in the street, or enlightened administration. Whoa! So, see, so they're playing the race card, but they're playing it, you know, in a very strong way. So there was a big backlash. In... The week before the election, there was a rally for the labor, for the alignment, in Kikar Malchei Yisrael, now known as Kikar Rabin. Okay, and at this gathering, there were tens of thousands of people, there was an entertainer, Dudu Topaz. Okay, so all the good people are here tonight. And then he said, and there are no chachchachim, which is a nasty term in referencing Eastern Jewry. So this was a real ethnic slur, like using the N-word, basically. And he was a shock jock type who later had problems and went to jail, as far as I can tell. He died a few years ago. He said something he shouldn't have said. And Menachem Begin... And he said, and where are the Likudniks? They're at Likud headquarters, Beit Ze'ev. You know, the Likud party headquarters, named for Jabotinsky. So the very next night, Likud runs a rally in Kikar Malchei Yisrael with thousands and thousands of people, and Menachem Begin gives probably his greatest speech of his career, in which he starts by saying that last night there was somebody here, and he reads the page, Dudu Topaz. Who is that? I don't know who that is. And he said, he used a nasty ethnic slur, and said that all the good Israelis are here and all the bad ones are elsewhere. So he says, my friends, Barazani and Feinstein. Barazani was Iraqi. Feinstein was Ashkenazi. He says, Ashkenazi, Iraqi, Yehudim, Achim, Lochamim. And the crowd goes wild. He won the election right there by saying that the other side are a bunch of divisive racists, bigots, and we represent Am Yisrael, and they're singing Begin Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, they're clapping hands, they love it. So he really was able to take the bigotry of the other side and translate it into success for himself. Okay. Okay, now let's talk about that. What were the facts? So, it should not be thought that the grievance of the Sephardic Jews in Israel in 1981 was economic in nature, and that it was lower class versus middle and upper class. It's not really fair to say that, because there were plenty of poor Ashkenazim and plenty of successful, materially successful Sephardim. The issue was more of a cultural grievance and a political grievance. And the political grievance, I'll explain... in one simple story. There was a longtime mayor of Be'er Sheva, Eliyahu Navi. He was from Baghdad, and longtime mayor, he was promised a realistic spot on the alignment list in 1981. What's a realistic spot? What does that mean? So a realistic spot means that, you know, the polls say you're going to win 40 seats, so you're in the first 30. You're pretty much guaranteed it's going to happen. What's a borderline spot? Anywhere in the 30s and low 40s, because maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't. What's an unrealistic spot? 55. You're not going to get in. Okay. So he was promised a realistic spot and had never been a member of the Knesset before, but was a long time Labor Party public figure, mayor of a major city. So it turned out that the alignment thought they were going to win 50-some-odd seats, but they didn't. They only won, as it turned out, 47. And Navi got bumped. He was too low down on the list. So he complained to Shimon Peres, Shimon, why are you doing this to me? You made a promise. So Shimon says, well, listen, I had to do this for this sectional group. I had to do this for this territory. Every constituency needed to be represented on the list. And lo and behold, I'm sorry, I couldn't put you high enough. As it turned out, you were number 50, whatever. I apologize. And the list already had three Iraqis.
Oh, there you go.
So Eliyahu Navi says to him, Shimon, I came to Israel at the age of 7 in 1927. You came to Israel at the age of 11... 7 years after me in 1934, yet you're an Israeli and I'm still an Iraqi.
Ah.
That's the whole story.
Yeah.
Sofa Maisa.
That's great.
So that shows that there was a sense of...
lack of acceptance.
That the other remains the other for decades on end and cannot infiltrate to the highest level. Okay. Well, The Labour Party recognizes...
They're still calling Franken.
Huh? Franken, yeah. So, the Labour Party recognized that they had this problem. And they tried to have representation on their list of people who were not from Russia, Poland, and Romania. So there who made the slate, who made the Knesset. And 14 members of the 47 members of the alignment who made it were Sephardic Jews. Only 9 out of the 48 Likudniks were Sephardim. So actually Labour had better representation. But what does this show? That it doesn't matter if you have a token person of a certain ethnic background on your list. That's just one man. The issue is broader than the one man on the list. The issue is, how are you treating the population as a whole? What do they feel is their relationship to the state as a whole? Okay. So, just before the election was the bombing of the Iraqi nuclear reactor, Osirak. How did this play into the electioneering? So, on the one hand, you could say it helped boost Begin and Likud over the top to help them win. And you'd probably be right to think that. But on the other hand, it was a risky move. What if it had failed?
Could start a war.
Yeah. So Peres had opposed the nuclear strike. And it was known that he opposed it. Before it happened, so his opposition was just within the government circles before anybody was aware of what was going to be. But after the event had taken place, his opposition now looks unpatriotic. And the Begin administration is able to play its hand, and maybe overplay its hand, by accusing Peres and the alignment as a whole of being unpatriotic. Peres would argue, it's not that he opposed bombing the reactor, it's that the timing was inappropriate. What was wrong with the timing? So number one, it's before the Israeli election. So if it fails, it benefits the Labour. If it's successful, it benefits the Likud. It's like cheating. You shouldn't have introduced this into the equation. But the other thing is, the very day of the bombing was the election in France, where Mitterrand was elected. Peres is a good buddy. So he also had other reasons why he opposed the timing. This idea that the Labour Party is unpatriotic, have we heard that before? So in the previous cycle, there was an ad that I showed you about how Arafat and Sadat are praying for a Labour victory. All right, but that was one ad run by the Meshuggah far right. But as a staple of Israeli politics, the notion that the left side of the aisle as a whole is unpatriotic really begins in 1981, because 1981 is the most nasty and vicious of all the cycles. But it will continue. It will continue into the 1990s. Most importantly, in 1995-96, when Rabin gets killed, and then the Peres versus Netanyahu election of 96. It no longer really is a factor in Israeli elections. For example, in 2019, nobody's accusing Gantz Lapid of being unpatriotic. They just have differences of policy over the territories with the Likud. But unpatriotic was a 1981 invention.
Was that, are there any, today you have people that are professional workers, like what Axelrod and those?
Oh, good. I'm glad you asked that. So this was the first election cycle that both the alignment and Likud hired American political operatives and strategists to run their affairs, to run the last stages of the campaign. This had not happened before.
So that may have brought in some of these...
The divisiveness.
Yeah.
You're probably right. That the nastiness of the American cycles are now introduced into the Israeli system. Huh?
No Russians.
So one of the important component is that Israeli law prohibits the premiministerial candidates from being seen on television in the months before the election. You're not supposed to have propaganda ads. You can have televised electioneering for a certain number of minutes that are allocated to you by the broadcasting authority, but outside of that, you can't have your guy on TV because it's seen as like cheating, as being getting extra publicity and extra electioneering that it's not warranted. So Begin was able to circumvent that. In early June of 1981, he had a meeting with Sadat. Now, relations between Begin and Sadat had collapsed in 1980, meaning after the signing of the accords on the White House lawn, there were supposed to be autonomy negotiations over the fate of the West Bank in Gaza. And those didn't go anywhere, largely because Menachem Begin didn't want them to go anywhere. All right, it was, remember, it's the fig leaf story. So Sadat was broigus with Begin, and they didn't see each other for a long time. But then Begin invited him to Ophira. Where is Ophira? By Sharm el-Sheikh. It was one of the settlements, Israeli settlements in the southern Sinai. And they shook hands on the tarmac, and they had, you know, the hug and kiss, a few-minute meeting. Whether there was any substance or not, who's to say? But the very fact that they met was a newsworthy item. And if it's a newsworthy item, it's not electioneering, and the media can cover it, the TV can show it. So now, what do you have? Begin the hawk, all right, supposedly the one who's not interested in peace and is going to bring disaster upon Israel because he's too much of a far-rightist, is making a peaceful gesture to Anwar Sadat. He got a boost in the polls, just like there was a boost in the polls when Sadat first came to Jerusalem in 1977. So he played it very nicely. Peres complained this was all a stunt, and maybe it was all a stunt, but it was a well-played stunt. Okay.
If it was a stunt, it had to have the cooperation of Sadat, so there must have been a relationship.
Sadat might have wanted Begin to win. I don't know. It's unclear.
Recently, when Netanyahu wanted to make a speech,
yeah,
it had to do with a 10-minute delay.
Something like that, yeah.
So is that what you
told me? I'm not sure what the rules are now. The Broadcasting Authority has different rules now than it did 40 years ago, but there may be an issue of it can't be live. I don't know.
Like in the United States, the Israeli people who are running don't have to pay for airtime?
No, it's allocated on the state networks, yeah. Okay.
Is it Caroline Glick is not writing now because she's...
It could be. She has to withhold from op-ed writing. Okay, so back to the violence issue. There were tomatoes thrown at Peres at the Memuna. What's the Memuna? Motzei Pesach by the Moroccans. So of all the various Sephardic groups, who gets accused the most of being violent? The Moroccans. Okay, so this was a manifestation of the worst of the stereotypes. All right, and the Ashkenazic Laborite alignment response was, this election is about the growers of tomatoes versus the throwers of tomatoes. All right, so, yeah. What was the American involvement in all of this? Putting aside political operatives and paid strategists, what was the relationship between Washington and the Begin administration, and which regime would it prefer, a labor alignment or Likud? So, in the 1980 presidential election in the United States, you have Jews supporting, some supporting Carter and some supporting Reagan. Jews typically, you know, voted for Democrats, but there were those who didn't like Carter. It was perceived as not necessarily being so closely aligned with Jewish interests, and that's maybe an understatement. So plenty of Jews voted for Reagan. What was Menachem Begin's position? Officially neutral, because after all, a foreign government isn't in the business of telling another democracy how to vote. But off the record, privately it was known that Begin preferred Reagan over Carter. Why? So number one, personal animus towards Carter because they didn't get along. But aside from that, Reagan was more vocally anti-PLO than Carter. That would change over time. The Reagan administration recognized the PLO at the end of his second term. But in 1980, Reagan was vocally anti-PLO. And, very important, Reagan did not regard Israeli settlements, civilian settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, as necessarily illegal, just that they were unwise, as opposed to Carter, who regarded them as an illegal act under international law. So for these two reasons, the settlement issue and personal preference, and the PLO issue, Begin. Did anyone support Carter? Anyone famous support Carter? Yes. Who did it? Azer Weitzman. Now, Azer Weitzman resigned as defense minister in the summer of 1980, and sort of just to stick it to Begin and to the Israeli regime that he had just walked away from, he openly campaigned for Jimmy Carter. forgotten point of history. But in 1981, what do the Americans think is their interests? Well, the Americans, the early Reagan administration, had a problem with Begin over the Iraqi nuclear reactor strike. Number one, there was an imposing of a delay of the delivery of F-16s, because the F-16s were used in the bombing, and they were only supposed to be used for legitimate defensive purposes. And the Begin's administration's response was, only we Israelis get to decide what are legitimate defensive purposes. Who are you to say that this wasn't? But ill will. And in the United Nations, the ambassador was instructed by the State Department to vote with everybody else condemning the strike. So it's possible that Reagan favored a Perez victory, but American interference was basically non-existent. And one of the reasons why it's non-existent is because Americans in Israel don't care about American interests. Very important point. This is never gets spoken about in any of the op-ed pieces. Israelis in America care about Israel and what the Israeli administration says is in the interests of Am Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael. Okay, you go to Forest Hills, half of Forest Hills is Israeli, they care what Bibi Netanyahu says. But if you go to Israel in 1981, the Americans in Israel in 1981 couldn't care less what Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan says is in the American interest vis-a-vis the state of Israel. They're Israelis. They care what Israel says about Israel. So you don't have a local constituency that's going to care about American interference or to project any electoral relevance to that interference. Yeah.
You don't have the Republicans abroad in Israel, Democrats
so
abroad in Israel.
You do, but back then it was a non-factor. Uh-huh. A non-factor.
Well,
yeah.
Now
it's a little different, yeah.
Did the Americans have any knowledge of the bombing of the Iraqi?
I don't think it was until after it was over.
But they had all the AWACS and everything else over.
Maybe they knew as it was happening, but I don't think they were given much advance warning. Yeah.
Both of those groups, the Israeli Americans, the Americans, they're statistically irrelevant.
Right. Well, it's interesting to point out, there were plenty of Americans in Israel in 1981, but they weren't identified so much as Americans. They were people who were born in America and made Aliyah at some point in their lives. They were mostly laborites. Today, if you think of the American Jew living in Israel, you think of an Orthodox Jew living in Modi'in, except that's 2019. In late 70s, early 80s, we're talking about people who moved much earlier, or maybe shortly after the Six-Day War, and who had socialist tendencies, not who were political rightists.
Where did they live?
All over, but Renata, all over.
A lot of them may have been European born.
Some were European born, lived in America, moved to Israel. Yeah, okay. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
How did that figure into, the relationship with Israel?
That will become a factor during Iran-Contra in the mid-80s, but not in 1981. Okay, so let's now go to see who won the election. Well, the polls close, and Shimon Peres won. Labor won the election. How do you like that? Labor won the election, except that they didn't. For about 3 hours,
Truman and Dewey,
good. For 3 hours, Labor thought they won. And Shimon Peres was trotted out onto the stage, and he gives a victory speech. Oh, I won, mazel tov to me, I'm so wonderful. And then more results come in, and he's got his hands over his face. Oh, you give out. Now, the truth is, even when Begin announced that he won early in the morning the next day, even then they really didn't know. Because the military vote had to be counted, and the military vote would be decisive. As it turned out, the difference was about 10,000 votes. So it wasn't until 4 days later, when it was certified, that you really knew what the results were. So when it was all counted, who won? Likud won 48 seats. The alignment won 47. So let me ask you a question. When you have something that close, does 48 really mean victory over 47? If this were the Electoral College in the United States, it would mean a definite victory, because that's an absolute thing. The winner wins. But in a parliamentary democracy, where the president of the state, as the head of state, gets to choose the next head of government, he or she could theoretically choose any major party leader and say, you are entrusted with forming a coalition. If you are successful at it, kol hakavod to you, you become the prime minister. Even if you, in fact, get a few seats less than the plurality party. But typically that doesn't happen. I think in the whole history of the state, it happened twice. Once with the Kadima beat out Likud, and once, well, in 84, well, it's a quirk because they had basically a tie. So, Labor lost by one. That alone didn't mean that they lost. They really lost because they couldn't form a coalition. Since the other 25 seats were allocated to parties that almost all of them, except one or two small ones, would not join with Shimon Peres in the alignment. Let's now review who got the other 25 seats. 48 plus 47 is 95. 120 minus 95 is 25. So there were small parties only won 25 seats. It's a pittance. The major parties almost won it all. The National Religious Party won 6 seats. National Religious Party is a right-wing party. Are they going to go to the alignment? No, they're going to go with Likud. The next one is Aguda. They won 4 seats. Are they going to go to the alignment? No, the alignment hates Haredim. They're going to go with the Likud. The next one is Chadash, the Arabs and the Communists. Are they going to go with either party? No, they're going to stay in the opposition and be the thorn in the side of the State of Israel. Okay, the next you have 3 seats to Chia, the far-right party of Geula Cohen that comes into existence just to oppose the Sinai withdrawal. Are they going to join with Labor? No, they're not even going to join with Likud, probably, because they're so meshuggah they can't join with anybody. Then Tami, the Sephardic party, Tenuat Moreshet Yisrael, led by Aaron Abuchatzera. It's not an ultra-Orthodox party like Shas. It's a traditional party. Religious, but not even necessarily Orthodox. Yarmulke wearing, a breakaway from the NRP. They won 3 seats. They're basically a right-of-center party. They're not going to go with the alignment. Then you have 2 seats for Telem, Moshe Dayan's party. They could go either way. Then 2 seats for Shinui, the change movement, which was the holdover from the DMC. And 1 seat for Shulamit Aloni and the citizens' rights libertarian types. So of all these minor parties, the only ones that could go to the left are Shinui and Citizens' Rights. That's 47 plus 2 plus 1 equals 50. 50 is nowhere near 60. Therefore, who wins the election? Menachem Begin. That's why he wins. Not because he got 48 versus 47, but because the math doesn't work out for the other side to win. But does the math work out for him to win comfortably? That's another question. So, who's going to join his government? The National Religious Party and the Aguda. And also Tommy, the Sephardics. That gives you 13 plus 48 equals 61. 61 is razor thin, but it's enough. You know, if you have to make do with 61, you make do with 61. What's going to be the character of this government if that's if those are all of its members? Frum, right wing on the territories and very religious. Okay, who's not going to be happy? The socialists and the Chilonim. All right, the secularists and the socialists and anyone who finds Begin to be anathema, they're going to be very disgruntled with this kind of government, a right, religious, orthodox government. But so it goes. Now, when you have a 61-member government and 3 junior partners, each one of those junior partners is absolutely essential. If they break away, you're doomed. So what are those 3 junior partners going to insist upon? A whole lot of goodies, a whole lot of political goodies. What do those include? Ministries, deputy minister positions, Arein Sof. Okay, the number of cabinet members grew exponentially. Now, that's not a good thing. A government should try to reduce the number of ministers because these are paid civil servants. Why should you waste a salary and a driver and a limo and all that? You know, it's a waste of money. But Begin had to do many ministers, many deputy ministers, and kesef in the budget. The money's going to go to what the Haredim want, what the National Religious want, and not to other constituencies. Now, remember that the Aguda doesn't like joining governments in any formal sense of controlling a ministry. What do they want instead? Money. Committee chairmanships in the Knesset. legislative committee chairmanships. Why? Because those people write the laws and write the budget. So they get exactly what they're looking for. Which means that the ministries that don't go to the Likud are going to go to the National Religious Party and Tommy. Okay. Well, now I ask you a question. The National Religious Party, they won 6 seats. In the previous election, they had 12. They were cut in half. They went from being a middle-sized party to being a minor party. What happened to them? Why did they lose so terribly? Okay, good. So that's one factor of probably about 3 or 4. Let's try to figure out all of them. So, first, the Likud issue. The National Religious Party appealed to the knitted yarmulke-wearing voter all these years because Israel is a secular state. It's not a religious state. It's a Western democracy run by basically, you know, secular people who don't wear yarmulkes and don't keep Shabbos. And the National Religious Party needs to be well represented to engage the state on matters of religion and state, lest the wrong kind of people make the decisions. And the Mapai, the Labor Party, the Alignment, are all suspect in the eyes of the religious audience. But who is not suspect on matters of religion and state in the eyes of your knitted yarmulke-wearing voter? Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin is Israel's first Jewish prime minister. Okay? Daniel Gordas wrote the biography of Begin a few years ago. We reviewed it in one of the previous lectures. Okay? He wanted the title of that book to be Menachem Begin, Israel's first Jewish prime minister, and his publisher wouldn't let him have that title. I forget in the end what the title was, but he wanted that to be the title because all his Begin's predecessors were really very secular and not with a Yiddish heart, a Yiddish tam. I mean, Ben-Gurion liked the Bible, but he was an avowed secular socialist, agnostic. Okay, Golda Meir was basically an atheist. And Levi Eshkol liked Yiddish, but he didn't like Yiddishkeit so much.
How religious was Menachem?
It's hard to say, but he said he said Tehillim while the F-16s were in the air. Pretty religious, right?
No one really knows how he was in private.
I don't know. Did he keep kosher?
Kosher probably.
I would imagine he kept kosher. Did he put tefillin every morning? I don't think so. I don't know, but I don't think so.
He described himself as being a Jew first and an Israeli second.
Well, that analysis of him would be correct. So, because the NRP doesn't have to fight against anti-Jewish forces at the top, the voter no longer feels it necessary to vote for the NRP. That's issue number one. Secondly, the NRP voter is a right-wing voter, hawkish in the territories. Well, they want to decide who wins the general election, so they have to vote for Likud, otherwise Labor might win. That's reason number two. Reason number three, well, if you're Sephardic and the ethnic angle is important to you, you're going to vote for Tami, Tenuat Moreshet Yisrael. Why does Tommy exist? Well, basically because the leader was a criminal. Unfortunately, in Israel's history, its major Sephardic parties have been led by criminals. And that feeds into the stereotypes. It's an unfortunate fact of Israeli political history that Aaron Abuchatzera and Aryeh Deri both were conmen. Okay, so Abuchatzera was the Minister of Religious Affairs in Begin's first term, and he was charged with embezzling funds. He was exonerated and later convicted on another charge, which he served. What's it called when you don't really go to jail? Not house arrest. It was.
Community service.
No, another term for it.
Parole?
Not parole.
Probation,
bingo, okay. So he didn't even resign from the Knesset. He resigned from the cabinet in 1982 because pashtus for a cabinet member to be a convicted felon, but he didn't resign from the Knesset. So Tommy was a breakaway on the grounds that the NRP was insufficiently sensitive to Sephardic needs, which it probably wasn't, and he needed to get away because of his own personal scandal. So they took 3 seats. That is coming at the expense of the NRP. What else is at the expense of the NRP? Tichiyah. the far-right anti-territorial concession party, if you're a Netanyahu Yarmulke type and you live in the West Bank, and in 1977 you voted for NRP, and in 1973 you voted for NRP, and in 1969 you voted for NRP, okay? But in 1981, what do you want to vote for? Maybe Likud to influence who wins the election, but maybe Tichia just to show I am a fundamentalist on Eretz Yisrael, and I will not give away one inch, not even of the Sinai. Okay? So all these factors work against the NRP. But truth be told, a lot of these factors work against the other small parties too. Why did the radical left get poorly represented in 1981? Because people who were radical left voters didn't want the alignment to lose to Likud, so what did they do? They voted for the alignment. So therefore, the Uri Avneris of the world, Moked, Meri, the radical camp, the Black Panthers, all that mishigas of the far left, those folks really didn't get anywhere. Chadash won 4 seats under Arab/Jewish auspices, but otherwise Shinoi won 2 seats and Shulamit Aloni won 1. This is much less than in all the previous cycles when far-left parties did reasonably well. Okay, so which party was not influenced by the fact that this was a two-party race? Aguda. Why Aguda?
Because they have a core constituency.
Okay, because Aguda has a core constituency that isn't really up for grabs with any other party. Except maybe the NRP is a borderline of the Chaydalniks, you know, maybe they could go one way or the other. But Aguda has its constituency, and they don't care who wins the general election. The Gedolim don't care whether Shimon Peres is the prime minister or Menachem Begin is the prime minister. Now, they may do better under Begin and quietly prefer that to be the outcome, but they're not going to have their audience put a slip in the ballot box for Menachem Begin. They're going to have their audience put a slip in the ballot box for Degel HaTorah Agudat Yisrael. Okay? And so it goes. They won 4 seats one time, they won 4 or 5 seats the next time. Very stable. Which party disappeared? Poalei Agudat Yisrael. Why did they disappear? Well, they were always the more marginal party among the Haredim, because they were sort of the moderate Haredim, but they would win 1-2 seats. You know, one time they won 3 seats. They won 0. Because their leadership took a hawkish stance on the territories. Once you take any stance on the territories, then why am I voting for you? I'll vote for Likud or Labor, based upon whatever stance I have that you have in common with me. And as for if I was going to vote for a Haredi party, so if I'm going to vote for a Haredi party, I'll vote for Aguda, the real Aguda, not the Poalei Aguda.
Was Min still a factor here, or he was gone?
No, he was gone. Kalman Kahana was the head of the party. So they disappeared, never to return, never to return. So Shas does not exist yet. The next cycle, 1984, they will exist because Tommy kind of fizzles out and there's a need for an ethnic Sephardic party. Ethnic party. Okay. Now, in the few minutes we have left, let me discuss a few other parties that didn't do well. Tell him, Moshe Dayan, he represented himself. In other words, he didn't really have an ideological perspective. Privately, he acknowledged he's closer to Labor than he was to Likud, despite having been foreign minister in the Likud government. And so people who voted for him just voted for him because he was Dayan. They like the eye patch. So he got 2 seats. He died a few months after the election, so that movement fizzled out. Another consideration is, what about the Arabs? Where are the Arab parties? I didn't mention one Arab party here. I mentioned Chadash, which is half Arab, I mean, maybe 90% Arab, but officially Arab-Jewish, and of the 4 representatives who were elected, 2 were Jews, Mayor Vilner, and I forget who the other one was.
Communist,
yeah. So Chadash is a combination of some Arab communists, Jewish communists, amalgam. Okay, so, but there was no regular Arab party beyond the communist branch. Why not? There always had been in every previous cycle. The answer is the Arabs are now becoming Palestinian. And so the days of satellite parties of the Mapai or Labor are over. They're not interested in voting for that. But the Arab parties, the nationalist Arab parties, have yet to get off the ground. They will in subsequent cycles, especially after the Intifada. But for the time being, who are the Arabs voting for if not for the Arab communists? They're voting for Labor. Why for Labor? because on matters of war and peace, they just don't want Likud, because Likud means Israel holding on to the territories. Arabs want the Palestinians to have their autonomy and their freedom, and so therefore the Arabs of Israel who don't vote communist will largely vote for the Labour Party. This will continue into the 1990s, but over time fizzle out as real Arab parties emerge. So, for example, in the last cycle, the United List won 13 seats. That's about as much as they could hope to get. It's 10% of the whole parliament. But in the early 80s, Arabs voted for Labour. Is that a sin? No, it's a political reality. Okay.
Were Christians ever involved in this at all? I don't even remember you mentioning Christians.
So, a significant portion of the Israeli Arabs are Christian. And they vote however they vote. Okay. So, 3 minutes left. Let's just discuss some other other issues in government in 1981. Okay. The... okay. So, the health of Menachem Begin. This was an issue. Begin, during the campaign, had said that he would only serve a half a term, and that he would retire on his 70th birthday. Now, he was born 1913, so his 70th birthday, 1983. 83 is halfway between 81 and 85. It's only a half a term. This proved to be detrimental to the Likud's chances in the election, because if a guy retires halfway through, well, who follows him? Are they going to announce who it is ahead of time? There's no clear choice. David Levy was officially the number two guy in the party, but number two is just a symbolic thing to throw to the Sephardim. Okay, so that was on purpose. They put up a Sephardic Jew to the top, the number two position. Not that he's the logical successor or that he would ever be a successor. We don't know who it would be. In the end, who was it? Yitzhak Shamir. But that was not known in 1981. It was far from certain. So, because this scares the voters, we don't know what we're getting into. An old man's going to retire halfway through the term. Why would I vote for him? So in May of 81, but a month before the election, Begin announces, no, I will serve the full term. I will serve the full term and then retire. He doesn't, because his health declines and his wife dies and he has a mental collapse and so on and so forth, which we'll talk about next week. But he needed to project the image of a strong man. Not a strong man, but a strong man. Zechiluk. Two words, not one word. But truth be told, his electorate would have liked the idea of a strong man. One word, strong man. Because much of the Likud voting population came from countries where there's no democratic tradition, and the strong man is the one who's in charge. So they like the idea of an aggressive politician at the top who speaks his mind and is not afraid of the consequences of his words, but is just going to run with it. Strong man. So where does Menachem Begin evince the greatest example of being a strong man? Huh? So not in terms of action of bombing a nuclear reactor, but in words. Answer is in his relationship with foreign heads of government. And this was part of his likability from an internal Israeli point of view, and why outside of Israel he was despised as a right-wing crank and as an unrepentant ex-terrorist. So Menachem Begin, unlike Shimon Peres is the slick, savvy diplomat who says the right thing to other heads of state. He knows how to play the game, the diplomatese. Menachem Begin was the other way around. He spoke aggressively. And two famous incidents stand out. One was when he testified in the United States Senate and spoke to Joe Biden. You ever see that clip on YouTube, go on YouTube, where he says, "I'm not a weak-kneed Jew trembling at your feet"? All right? That was one example. But the more important example was Germany. Germany wanted a PLO state. Germany was dissatisfied that the autonomy talks after Camp David had fallen flat, and they wanted to see progress in matters of West Bank and Gaza. Now remember, Konrad Adenauer had good relations with David Ben-Gurion. Willy Brandt had decent enough relations with Golda Meir. Who's the Chancellor of Germany then? Helmut Schmidt. And Menachem Begin said, "Excuse me, Herr Schmidt. You know, I'm not going to listen to you, who want a PLO state and are going to make my people in danger of Katyusha rockets falling on their head. You, who come from a country that killed 6 million of my parents and brothers and sisters." So he played the Holocaust card against Helmut Schmidt in a way that no other Israeli leader had ever spoken about or to a German leader from the time of the establishment of the state. And the internal Israeli audience, they loved it. They ate it up. Why? Because as much as Ben-Gurion's deal with West Germany was necessary for the money and for the political and military support, deep down the feeling was never there. The feeling was always antagonistic. And Begin expressed it in the right way. Adon Schmidt, he would say.
Yeah. Because
his family was killed. He spoke against it in 1952. Oh, and so the last point for tonight, I'm glad you mentioned it, because when the tomatoes were flying, and there were incidents in May and June of 81, where Perez and Rabin had to be whisked away by Shin Bet security guards because it was getting too excitable in the crowd, so this was a real problem. The argument that Labor made was, this is not a new thing. This goes back to February of 1952, when Menachem Begin stormed the ramparts of the Knesset, you know, went up the hill on Ben Yehuda Street from Kikar Tzion, up the hill to the Frohman House, and banging on the gates of the Knesset and saying, "We're going to take it over by force if we have to undo the Wiedergutmachung." So there was a long history of anti-German sentiment, and the Labor would argue a long history of fascistic behavior and violent behavior. But with this we'll conclude. Did the Labor Party, did the Likud Party really have a role in fomenting the worst aspects of this cycle, the violence? Labor said yes. There's no evidence that is true. Most likely, things get out of hand because things get out of hand. You don't need to have some puppeteer at the top manipulating the hooligans. Once there's a strong sentiment on the street, then things get settled on the street. But thank God for Israel, the final conclusion is at the ballot box and not with fisticuffs in the ballyard. Okay, stop here.